Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
I saw a phantom threat the night before I began writing this podcast. Now, I'm not a P.T. Anderson fan, but I prefer this one, at least, to a number of his other movies. At this point, there's not even a doubt. P.T. Anderson is the most acclaimed filmmaker of Generation X. Quentin Tarantino is, of course, his nearest rival, and still the director who defines the generation's ethos. But what goes up must come down, and the world clearly hates Quentin Tarantino right now as much as they used to love him. For the last 20 years, the acclaim for P.T. Anderson was consistent, universal, and, if only in my opinion, undeserved. Now, like everybody, I love Boogie Nights. Like Pulp Fiction, or Jaws, or The 400 Blows, or Citizen Kane, it's a movie in which a new director of huge gifts announces himself and shows exactly how brilliant he is. The whole thing manages to be both excessive and perfect. It's the gaudy 70s excess of Southern California, in which the porn industry is just an extreme example of the excess people put into living everywhere during that rather perverse decade. It's the movie Anderson was born to make, and frankly, it's all been somewhat downhill from there. Right after Boogie Nights was Magnolia, which this director, with an extreme eye for style, tried to match his style with emotional substance. I don't think it really needs to be said, but P.T. Anderson is not Ingmar Bergman, and Sweden isn't the San Fernando Valley. And it's treacherous waters to try to create characters of enormous depth in a place where everybody tries to be so superficial. The only other movie of his I really like is Punch Drunk Love. It's not a perfect movie, but it's so strange that it's hilarious, and I'm sure that's exactly how it's meant. Anderson is clearly a director whose natural inclination is to light and exuberance. He's what the English would call a high comedian, whose natural inclination is to create works that are both light and erudite. And like in Tarantino, even the violence is comic. But America doesn't like high comedians. The idea that anybody can be proud enough of being smart to wear their intelligence lightly is about as un-American an inclination as there is. So as P.T. Anderson supposedly matured, he's done everything he can to suppress his natural exuberance so that the public will take him more seriously. I still haven't seen Inherent Vice, and frankly, it's a subject matter that strikes me as perfect for P.T. Anderson. So everything I say from now on in this podcast, I may eat the words of. But except for Heart 8, I've seen everything else, and I think I've seen enough to know that even if Inherent Vice is any good, it's still a blip on a trajectory. Now, the San Fernando Valley, or the Valley, is the place where P.T. Anderson grew up, and Boogie Nights proved that its superficiality is his natural home. But for the rest of his career, he's tried very hard to be deep, and to me, P.T. Anderson's movies read like a Playboy's vision of intellectual depth. Many people believe There Will Be Blood is the greatest movie of its decade, but I think it's a bit like watching beautiful paint dry. The central set piece of the oil explosion was stunningly beautiful, but the movie is so hypnotized by the landscape and Daniel Day-Lewis's incredibly hammy performance that it didn't take care, really, to truly examine the issues it brought up. I'm sure many people think that the movie says something very deep about the American clash between big business and religion, but look around. What's amazing about big business and religion in America is not that they clash, but they get along so well. If the movie was really a statement about America, Daniel Plainview would have found Jesus, gone into business with Eli Sunday, and they would have beaten the union negotiator with bowling pins, Goodfellas style. But you'd have to be a fool not to see that There Will Be Blood also has some enormous strengths. Anderson clearly knows California, and he photographs the lonely locations with a desolation that's a perfect reflection of the story he's trying to tell. Yes, Daniel Day-Lewis overacts, but at least it distracts from the paucity of material he has to work with. But better than DDL is Paul Dano's haunting performance as the Sunday twins. 10 years later, Eli Sunday's preacher scenes still haunt me, while DDL's overacting just makes me laugh. Both performances, in some ways, do work as reflections of their surroundings. I forget which critic says that Daniel Plainview's voice sounds like the oil he mines, but there is something about his voice and cadence that does smell of gasoline. It's like a cross between John Huston and Burt Lancaster. Now, it is, for me, a 2.5-star movie whose grim heaviness the intellectually insecure film world mistakes for sublimity. The Master, on the other hand, is just plain bad. Unintelligible, plotting, mesmerized by its photography, and did I mention that the plot is unintelligible? Anderson has proven over and over again that he can create great scenes, and there's no doubt that the scene on the boat between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix is masterly. But a great movie does not need great scenes if every scene around it is incoherent. Scenes for P.T. Anderson are just another elaborate set piece. A movie with 20 good scenes and no bad ones is a whole that exceeds the sum of its parts. So what the hell is the ending of that movie supposed to mean? I doubt Anderson thought about it half as deeply as the people who watched it. What the hell is the point of Joaquin Phoenix leaving the cult by driving off into the distance, except to showcase Anderson's brilliant desert photography? And what the hell is the point of that scene where everybody gets naked for about 20 seconds, only to be fully clothed again in the next shot? So much of that movie is absolutely comprehensible because P.T. Anderson is a virtuoso organizer of gimmicks, but beneath the surface of his movies is more surface. Now, on the strength of Boogie Nights, I persist with Anderson, waiting for him to discover in what direction his real potential lies and build on his initial great achievement. But he persists in mining this phantom realm of intellectual gravitas he doesn't have. Phantom Thread seems, to me at least, the logical endpoint of his current trajectory. A movie by a brilliant director who cares about nothing but surface and style, about a brilliant fashion designer who cares nothing about surface and style. It lays bare Anderson's essential artistic bankruptcy as though it were a confession. For 3 hours we dine with a man whose extremely specific habits are a way of shielding himself from life, and who makes luxury products that nobody but the extremely wealthy could ever appreciate, and by living through an unbreakable routine eviscerates any semblance of vitality which the chaos of life might give him. When Daniel Day-Lewis announced his retirement after Phantom Thread, citing that this part drained him, I was cynical about the claim for a number of reasons. Reason number one is that Daniel Day-Lewis just came out of retirement to play this role. His third retirement, for those who are counting, this new one is retirement number four. This was Daniel Day-Lewis's first role since Lincoln, 5 years ago, and after Lincoln, he went back into seclusion on his Georgian estate. Reason number two is that in the midst of the Me Too imbroglios, it would have behooved many actors to lay low. The timing of DDL's announcement, always extremely cautious about his choices, seemed to me a little suspicious. Finally, and most importantly, reason number three. Daniel Day-Lewis said that the reason he's retiring is that the part of Reynolds Woolcock was simply too draining to ever act again. No actor since Marlon Brando has been so famous for his character preparation, and Daniel Day-Lewis goes so much further with method preparation than Brando ever did. As many people have pointed out, method acting is the favored preparation of so many famous male actors. Brando, of course, but since him, Robert De Niro, Dustin Hoffman, Al Pacino, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Christian Bale, Joaquin Phoenix, Shia LaBeouf, and of course, the late Heath Ledger, whose method acting may have killed him. Meanwhile, Meryl Streep just shows up. Occasionally you hear about Hilary Swank or Charlize Theron going method, but Kate Winslet, Julianne Moore, Helen Mirren, Kate Blanchett, Jodie Foster, when has anyone ever heard a story about an indisputably great actress carrying her work home with her? This is not yet another podcast in which the author calls out sexism or the disparities of behavior between men and women. My point in bringing this up is that if there were any appreciable difference in the quality between male actors, so many of whom quote-unquote go method, and female actors, the vast majority of whom just act, then the method would have something to recommend itself. As it stands, the method seems more like narcissism than acting. Just think of There Will Be Blood. Daniel Day-Lewis, the world's most famous A-list actor with a capital A, spent a year preparing to be its main character, Daniel Plainview. His antagonist was played by Paul Dano, who was hired to play Eli Sunday on a Thursday and had to start shooting Monday. Even if nobody agrees with me that Dano was better in that movie than DDL, everybody agrees that this 23-year-old B-list actor completely kept up with the emperor of the profession. Daniel Day-Lewis grew up in England, where he was thoroughly trained in the most classical traditional style of acting in which you don't prepare for the part with research or carrying your character over to everyday life. You just do the role by knowing the text like the back of your hand. In a repertory theater company, there's no time for that kind of exhaustive research. But what you lose in inwardness, you gain in the strength of having a cohesive cast that acts with one another in production after production and spends decades learning how to make a cohesive ensemble and play off your colleagues. If Daniel Day-Lewis is so tired of the method, then, as Olivier said to Dustin Hoffman, why doesn't he just try acting? But once you see Phantom Thread, you realize that his claim about this part draining everything from him was absolutely serious, and there needn't be any other reason for his retirement. The movie itself is not bad, it's just rather bland. I'd give it a soft 7 out of 10 or 3 stars out of 4. For those who've seen it, you know that the ending is not exactly coherent, but it's still pretty funny, and it's nice to know that Anderson can still occasionally let his sense of humor out. But in both the cases of Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis, the character of Reynolds Woolcock can be a stand-in for the essential decadence of their approaches to their art. DDL claimed that both he and P.T. were utterly drained and depressed from the experience of making it. And when you see it, you might infer exactly why that is. Since 2000, nearly every movie either has ever made is greatly revered without being loved. With the possible exceptions of Lincoln and Punch Drunk Love, they both make utterly cold products, divorced from life as most people live it. It must have been like turning their eyes into their very souls and seeing the reflection of something neither wanted to admit, that if the purpose of art is to hold the mirror up to nature, then they both have lived a middle age that holds nature at bay. And if that was the realization they had, it must have been devastating. P.T. Anderson is a director who practically defined what fashion was in the cinema world for 20 years, and he made a movie that is completely tone-deaf to the zeitgeist. And were it made 20 years ago, it would have been the kind of movie Harvey Weinstein would have financed, a movie for people over 70 who spent their younger years watching Merchant Ivory movies and Masterpiece Theater adapt Victorian novels that they never finished. It's a costume drama about how a wife finds satisfaction in ministering to a white male genius who dresses the super rich. When I got home, I looked P.T. Anderson up and I realized that he's been married to Maya Rudolph since 2001, which in Hollywood is an eternity, and that they have 4 children. Maya Rudolph is, of course, one of the most brilliant comic actresses alive, but for the last 10 years, her most famous appearance is defecating in a sewer while playing backup to Kristen Wiig in Bridesmaids. Now, perhaps while she was on SNL, P.T. Anderson was the one taking time off for the kids, and admirably, Anderson has waited years between every project. A full 5 years between There Will Be Blood and The Master, and 3 years between Inherent Vice and Phantom Thread. Nevertheless, since Maya Rudolph left Saturday Night Live in 2007, Anderson's made 4 movies, all of which got huge critical acclaim. There's a clear disparity in their partnership, and in an era when awe at the male genius is no longer what it was, P.T. Anderson, be his achievements great or small, is beginning to look seriously unfashionable. When you hear Reynolds Woolcock's narcissistic cry of despair at people preferring other dress designers because they're thought more chic, and his agony at how he thinks his marriage is destroying his creativity, you begin to wonder who's really doing the talking. Now, about 5 years ago, Wes Anderson, P.T. Anderson's homonymic rival for cinematic prestige, was at a similar crossroads in his career. He was mesmerized by style, by irony, by immaculate shot composition. He was still enamored of his fashionability, but after the disaster that was Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and shut up, it's terrible, he was no longer fashionable. But rather than make movies, as he so often did, about adults who act like children, he made Moonrise Kingdom, a movie about the virtues of children. Rather than make a movie about artificially affected people, he made Grand Budapest Hotel, about an era in human history when pretentious affectation was a virtue. In losing his fashionability, Wes Anderson gained substance, and perhaps the time's finally arrived when P.T. Anderson will do the same, because the world isn't the 90s anymore. The 90s were a decade populated by these young cinematic puppies filled with knowledge about film and little knowledge about life. The boy prophet was Quentin Tarantino, and David Lynch was his John the Baptist. And then there were apostles like the Andersons, the Coens, the Wachowskis, Spike Jones and Charlie Kaufman, the Davids Fincher and Russell, Steven Soderbergh, Christopher Nolan, Gus Van Sant, and exactly one woman, Sofia Coppola, the daughter of a Hollywood king. And she didn't even break off onto her own until the turn of the century. These are film bros, whose cinematic subject is usually involving technology of some sort, and are all possessed of technique so virtuoso that admiration of it precludes almost every other quality in the movie. And they're so filled with knowledge of film that half the shots are homages. In these movies, everything in a face or nature can be airbrushed in a computer, and the movies of these cold fish are cold enough to give off the glare of the computer screen. Now, sure, there are exceptions. One or two movies by most of these directors I like or love, and directors like Richard Linklater, Alexander Payne, or Jason Reitman do work that is far more human. But they're the exceptions, and speaking personally, I've had a rule the last few years that whatever movie people buzz about, wait 5 years to see if people are still talking, or if it's simply tossed off like another gadget. Though, let's be honest, I usually don't last the full five, or I just never get around to seeing it. So as far as I know, there have never been stories with P.T. Anderson of the kind of on-set tyranny one gets about some of these cold fish like the Davids, Russell, and Fincher. Working with P.T. Anderson doesn't seem to be a particular ordeal, and he's not even a director, about which co-workers seem to have ambivalent feelings the way they have about Quentin Tarantino, whom everybody seems to agree is a fundamentally warm-hearted guy who can turn into a loose cannon. P.T. Anderson is not a particular dinosaur in any of his attitudes. He is only a dinosaur in the sense that nobody can articulate the ethos of an age forever. Anderson is pushing 50, and in relatively quick succession, he has been the director of movie after movie, fascinated with the stories of men who would be great. Perhaps for the first time in the entirety of human history, stories about ambitious men are deeply, deeply unfashionable. And true to the spirit of our time, we're now seeing movies pop up left and right, which tell stories about everybody else. And it's thrilling enough for me to see something new at the movies that I'm now violating my rule about waiting 5 years. None of these movies so far, not even Lady Bird, strikes me as a masterpiece. But seeing these movies has gotten me more excited to regularly go to new movies than perhaps I've been since college. Every week this Oscar season, it seemed like a new movie was coming out whose approach was completely new and different, and no longer brined in the style and irony that we usually see, and no longer taking a back seat, as it has for 20 years, to the substance over style which we see everywhere on television.
This episode is sponsored by...
Oh no, we have some bad news. Writing a great book isn't all it takes to be a successful author. That's why we created the Possibilities Conference, where we transform writers into professional authors. Join us on April 7th in Falls Church, Virginia, where you can look forward to the Pancakes with Publishers breakfast, dynamic workshops, even a media lounge where you can leave with free headshots and an author promo video for your media kit. All this and so much more. Grab your tickets at thepossibilitiesconference.com.
So what about these movies signify a new direction? Let's start with the obvious place, this year's Oscar winner, The Shape of Water, made by Guillermo del Toro. P.T. Anderson is brilliant, but Guillermo del Toro is a genius. Now, like the true Californian P.T. Anderson is, he pursues style for its own sake. But in del Toro's movies, style is only there to illuminate substance. Look at Pan's Labyrinth, which is my choice for the greatest movie of the 2000s, and wonder to yourself if there isn't a single image in the whole movie that doesn't illustrate a deeper mythical, historical, or philosophical point. The movie is absolutely bottomless, and if you can stomach multiple viewings, there are no end of meanings to find within it. The Shape of Water is not Pan's Labyrinth. It's a Guillermo del Toro project almost deliberately scaled to be no larger than Hollywood would ever risk. Guillermo del Toro already has 25 projects that never got off the ground. It may be the most since Orson Welles, and when you look at del Toro's finished products, you can wonder if he's a Welles-level genius. The projects include The Wind in the Willows, George R. R. Martin's Sand King, Thor, The Hobbit, Tarzan, Dracula, Roald Dahl's The Witches, Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, Beauty and the Beast, The Hulk, Godzilla, a Wolverine X-Men project, and a stop-motion animation of Pinocchio. Genius, real genius, makes its own rules. It doesn't know the definition of highbrow or lowbrow. It just creates and incorporates whatever influence seems useful. Now, in Hollywood, the inability to work within a system is almost a badge of honor. It's a sign that your talent cannot be contained by commercial limitations. Entertainment makes money, but art costs money. And Hollywood does not like taking chances on directors that are too good if the result is art rather than entertainment. Just think of all the famous Hollywood projects that, for whatever reason, never materialized. Think of the last 20 years of D.W. Griffith's life. Think of Stroheim's Queen Kelly, David Lean's Nostromo, Leone's Leningrad, Kubrick's Napoleon, Jerry Lewis's The Day the Clown Cried, Khodorovsky's Dune, Ridley Scott's Blood Meridian, Coppola's Megalopolis, Gilliam's Don Quixote, Louis Malle's Moon Over Miami, Herzog's Conquest of Mexico, Scorsese's Gershwin, Malick's The English Speaker, Cronenberg's Frankenstein, Lynch's Ronnie Rocket, Stallone's Edgar Allan Poe, Fincher's Heavy Metal, and even the Beatles wanted to make Lord of the Rings, and Steven Spielberg had Night Skies, which was a kind of horror sequel to Close Encounters. And then there's Orson Welles. A full three-quarters of his projects were either never made or never finished, and those are only the ones we know about. Film, for better or worse, is so expensive and chaotic that the ability to make art out of it, the way one might with a novel or painting, is almost antithetical to its spirit. Film is a machine so cold that it can manipulate your emotions. It's almost synthetic. Art can certainly be made from it, but when the expectation of what it does is so ironclad, the running time, the story, the genre, it's very difficult to call a huge amount of it art. Now, to those of you who are children of the internet, no doubt most people listening to this on the internet, who bristle at the idea that most movies are not art, let alone most video games, let me ask you something. How many more movies before Star Wars have you actually watched? And when you do, how many of them have you liked? Now, I love classic Hollywood, and I think many of the movies are a lot more entertaining than the latest superhero or horror flick. But the very great majority of them, even the classics, languish unseen by an ever-increasing number of people who fancy themselves movie buffs. Even the majority of people obsessed by movies in 2018 write them off as formulaic and dull. I think that's unfair, but if so many of them were made by formula, it's because the formula was considered a successful and lucrative form of entertainment that made money relative to the price it costs. Orson Welles is art. Bergman and Renoir are art. Truffaut and Herzog are art. And they're sufficiently individuated from other movies that I'm fairly sure they'll be appreciated for their differences in 400 years. Art can certainly be entertaining, but it must be meaningful. And the meanings must be new from age to age. So I have some, I think, understandable doubts that even the best westerns or romantic comedies or superhero movies or maybe even film noir are art in any particularly deep sense. I could, of course, be wrong, but when you see a real genius of film and you see how much trouble they have getting their projects made while workmen who make a reliable product churn out movie after movie, it's difficult not to appreciate a great chasm between what one kind of filmmaker makes and another. Were all of these unfinished projects going to be great? Of course not. I guarantee many of them would have sucked and played to the director's worst, most undisciplined instincts. Money men may be slime, but sometimes they're right. And yet, there's equally no doubt some of these would have been utterly dimensional portholes, bending the history of film and art itself into something we can never know about. A director like P.T. Anderson can consistently get his movies made because his movies, ultimately, are a little predictable. They're worthy projects of high prestige whose audience is a known commodity, but who rarely ever truly get surprised. But when you have a talent that is nothing short of genius, your talent is too explosive to be contained. Every project is a roll of the dice which could make or bankrupt a studio. This is why John Ford made 146 movies, and there exist only 13 finished movies by Orson Welles. Del Toro said that had this film flopped, he would have retired from filmmaking altogether. His confidence has clearly been shaken by the hostility of so many producers and studios. And I worry that, like so many filmmakers of genius as they become middle-aged, he's so worn down by hearing the word no that he will never again be as audacious. The Shape of Water is scaled down, Del Toro, low-key, perhaps even chastened, and as a reward for clamping down on his explosion of talent, Hollywood gave him their highest honor. We've seen both the monster and the ending of The Shape of Water in Hellboy, almost completely unchanged. The fascist villain in Pan's Labyrinth is reshaped for the contours of mid-century America, but it is still the same basic template. Hell, the healing powers of the monster is basically ripped straight from E.T. There's something almost cynically calculated about The Shape of Water that panders to the exact political climate of today. It's one thing to create an almost deliberately unrealistic villain from a military officer in fascist Europe, like in Pan's Labyrinth, because in our era, fascist soldiers now stand as an archetype for evil itself, particularly because we're scared of their return. Maybe I'm too behind the times or too trapped in my own male privilege, but a caricature of what's now termed toxic masculinity, which I believe is what Michael Shannon's character is supposed to be in this movie, it just doesn't have the same weight in my imagination, and I doubt it does for too many others. I have no doubt that many American white men were assholes, and I have equally no doubt that many of them committed all manner of abuse and villainous acts, but they were not genocidal in intention or results, and there were plenty of people in their day whose intentions and actions were far more evil, probably including the Soviet spy played by Michael Stuhlbarg, who was treated with a sympathy such a character does not deserve. I would like to think that these are not political points, but artistic ones. Michael Shannon is one of Hollywood's natural villains and heavies whose menace can elevate any project. He was very nearly the best thing about Boardwalk Empire. But he can only do so much to elevate the menace of a character who seems more like a projection of fashionable attitudes than eternal villainy. Evil as sexual harassment and assault, of course, are, and I wish the current political climate didn't make me have to give that proviso. I find it very hard to get it out of my mind that Michael Stuhlbarg's character was probably a soldier in the Red Army during World War II who probably took part in the mass rape of millions of Eastern and Central European women. We are asked in The Shape of Water to root for and against people whom at least my natural inclinations tell me do not deserve the allegiance for which we're asked. Pan's Labyrinth is an eternal masterpiece, The Devil's Backbone scarcely less. Both of them project the past incredibly, and Pacific Rim does the same for the future. But while The Shape of Water takes place in the past, it's clearly a work of 2017, and as such a perfect reflection of its time, it not only reflects what's wrong with our time, but also what's right with it. The central romance between a mute woman and a monster is absolutely gorgeous. I find it very hard to see it and not think that an allegory for trans or intersexual romance is deliberately intended, and I believe it is beautiful. Think of the line from this movie. When he looks at me the way he looks at me, he does not know what I lack or how I am incomplete. He sees me for what I am as I am. He's happy to see me. And I did my best to enunciate the ellipses in there. The main characters in this movie, a mute woman, an African-American woman, and a closeted gay man, are all treated with luminous humanity. And the Busby Berkeley musical number towards the end is amazing, in part because it's so unexpected. I suppose I can understand why some differently abled people find it ableist, but you cannot tell me that at moments of extreme joy, everyone in the world doesn't at some point long to shout or sing or exclaim to express themselves. I believe this is inherent in everyone's fantasy life. The scene captures a longing that is absolutely universal, and if you told me that some people wouldn't ever want to express themselves that way, I wouldn't believe you. Now, like Mad Men, this is a second draft of history in which the past is seen through present eyes, but Mad Men, extraordinary as it was made of acid and treated its quote-unquote different characters with a merciless realism. Think of Sal, the closeted gay man fired because a client came on to him whom he refused, or Midge, Don's bohemian artist girlfriend who ends up addicted to heroin, or Paul Kinsey, the copywriter neglected by Don, who ends up in a cult, or Michael Ginsberg, born in a concentration camp, who eventually turns schizophrenic, or, of course, Lane Price. The greatest strength, though, of The Shape of Water is that, as a fairy tale, it gives hope to these kinds of characters which in mid-century America had none, and in doing so expresses a hope and longing for the present and future which is incredibly moving. But it might also be a weakness. In an era that elected Donald Trump, how much chance is there that this vision of the future proves true? I have no idea. The ending of Pan's Labyrinth was both devastating and hopeful, that even if there is no justice in the real world, there exists in some dimension a world where we are rewarded for our suffering. Great as so much of The Shape of Water is, it feels a little bit like the punches are pulled. As a fairy tale, it works on the level of telling us, wouldn't it be nice if the world worked out like this? But it works as a fairy tale because the reality for these characters has been so grim for so long. And now that they have a chance to live their best lives, the advantaged white males of the world are clamping down on preserving the privileges they still have as mercilessly as they can. But what makes The Shape of Water give us hope for the future is that it's such an example of a traditional great director turning his focus to people so different than himself. Imagine Citizen Kane from the point of view of Susan Alexander, or The Godfather from the point of view of Mama Corleone. To do it, Guillermo del Toro turned down his explosion of metaphysical visuals to give us space for atypical characters, people who don't usually get a place to express themselves in a movie. The Shape of Water isn't a masterpiece. Some of the characters are simple stereotypes, and when we're really being honest with ourselves, even Octavia Spencer's part is a little bit mammy-ish. But the effort made to get into the shoes of these characters who've existed on the fringes is extraordinary in a manner that very few mainstream Hollywood releases ever try. And because Del Toro is just so good, it's extraordinary how well he succeeds. Regardless of how all of this is significant politically, it makes for a genuinely unique movie. When you compare this to P.T. Anderson's More of the Same Ambitious Men, you realize that this is indicative of a new wind blowing through North American movies that can vastly increase their quality, which, let's face it, has been suffering for an entire generation. Next week, we're going to compare Selma, another very old-fashioned movie from 4 years ago, to Get Out and possibly Black Panther and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, completely different kinds of movies about race whose popularity exposed just how much America has changed between 2014 and 2018.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?